Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. This week's guest will make you truly think about your life on Earth. Her name is Rita Zoe Chin, and her memoir, Let the Tornado Come, details her life as a child of physical and emotional abuse, how she attempted to escape the pain. Starting at 12, she ran away from a hateful mother and a truly abusive father, and became a homeless prostitute at 14. After her mother falsely accused her of attack, she was institutionalized for years. During this time, she was forced into sex slavery and fell victim to severe cocaine addiction. We'll all get the grisly details of her past, but we're also going to see how this woman has grown, survived, and thrived, and stands out as a truly superior human being. This is a show you're going to truly be riveted to. Rita, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. You got a sweet voice, too.
Oh, wow. Thank you. My gosh. I like, this is great. If I'm going to call your show every day if you just keep complimenting.
There you go. Yeah, so let's jump a little bit into some things that are a little less pleasant. You've had quite a childhood, and you've had quite a journey. And along that journey, you've learned a lot, had a lot of pain, and came out with a lot of insight, hence the book. But let's start out with what 99% of people go to shrinks to actually emote is about the relationship with their parents and how that relationship has hurt them. You, in particular, have great reason to have those feelings. Tell me about your mom. Tell me about her abandoning you in public spaces. Tell me whatever you want to tell me about mom.
Well, you know, I think, well, the abandoning in public spaces, it's an interesting thing because we, you know, our home life was very violent. And at a very young age, I think there was a part of me that imagined fleeing. And, you know, sometimes when we'd be out, like in a shopping mall or whatever, I'd want something, like a stuffed animal, for example. And, you know, I wouldn't be able, she would say no, you know, and I would do the thing that kids do, which is I would become petulant. or pouty, and sometimes I would follow her at a great distance in the store just to make her kind of wonder where I was, but she didn't seem to care. So then I'd have to kind of amp it up a little once we got outside, and she'd tell me to get in the car, and I'd refuse. And somebody recently said to me, you know, that everything we do is either an expression of or search for love. And I think that that's, excuse me, I think that that's what I was looking for. But what my mother did was she rolled the window back up, put the car in drive, and drove away. So was the first time of many times that we'd have this kind of standoff where we'd be out in a public place and she'd tell me to get in the car and I'd say no.
Obviously there was some major things diagnostically wrong with your mother, but underneath there sounds like there is a tremendous cruelness and control function. Now, you're right that every child wants love, but they want safety, they want predictability, they want everything that you didn't have. It's interesting that your obstinance on some level was your salvation, because otherwise you would have been literally, she would have just sucked you dry like a zombie. Sorry, again.
No, absolutely. So many people, who have found out that, that I was a runaway or was on the streets for several years, their first impulse is to be like, oh, I'm so sorry, that's terrible. And, it wasn't a picnic for sure, but it absolutely saved my life getting away
absolutely.
From my parents. Yeah.
Yeah, and most people don't realize, it's so funny that, they feel bad for the kids on the street and not realizing that on the street you're fending for yourself, you're meeting good people, bad people, and people, everyone has some self-interest, but you were living with very sadistic parents. I want you to talk to me about some of the other sadistic natures of your mom and of your dad?
Well, you know, my father, I think my mother was more just caught up in a perpetual whirlwind of self-hatred that kind of spun out of her in every direction, and I was the primary kind of focus for it. You know, but my father and mother fought terribly too. My father was definitely more of a sadistic personality in the sense that he would if I were walking past him, he would trip me and then laugh. Like, that was a common thing. Or he, you know, I once asked him if it would hurt very badly if you were in a car accident. And which is a stupid question, but I was a very young child, so I forgive myself.
But there are no stupid questions. And that's what kids do. They ask questions.
Right. So I was asking a question, like, you know, just, I guess, yeah, and he said, well, we were in a parking lot, and he said, go ahead and rest your face up against the dashboard. And, you know, stupid me, I did. And then he accelerated and hit the brakes. And, you know, of course, I banged my lip on the dashboard and it hurt. And so I got my answer. But he did other things that were really, you know, probably more on the sort of antisocial scale. Like, he would, you know, fry ants with a magnifying glass or shoot worms with a BB gun. So he was, I think, definitely more,
I think he passed antisocial into sociopathic.
Okay.
Yeah, he kind of took the express train right over that antisocial bridge.
I shouldn't be laughing at this. It's
no,
yeah,
you know
such
what?
Great
you know
distance.
What? You should be, because you survived. Survivors get the laugh. Okay.
Thank you.
You know, and the one thing that I want, you know, people to know is that people have this false sense of guilt. You know, honor thy mother and thy father. Well, you know, what that means is that if a person is truly a mother and truly a father, and not just an egg donor and a sperm donor who happen to be cruel, sadistic, you know, people, you have no necessity to honor them or even deal with them. You know, and getting away from them as quick as possible, that was a good thing.
Yeah, you know, although it took me many years to really emotionally get away, because I think, you know, as a child and even as an adult, I mean, there's a certain kind of hope we hold out for our family and particularly our parents. And I always wanted to love them. I still wish them absolutely everything good in life, but I just don't talk to them anymore. But I had to absolutely sever the relationships in order for me to truly, finally be free.
Rita, you know, it's interesting. The word curse means to tie up, and the word bless means to loosen. And and when you bless them, you're just loosening up, you know, all the damage that was done to you by them. And it just shows that two very cruel people could produce one very kind, sensitive, and aware child. So, you know, there goes the.
You're very kind. Thank
well,
you.
Well, you know what? So are you. Let's talk about the first time you ran away. What pushed you over the edge?
My father had gone into my room again and gone through my personal things, and I had this red purse with all these little keychains on it of like dogs and things like that. And he and my stepmother, his wife, had it kind of splayed out on their bed, and they were going through like my personal letters, and they had called me in. I was playing outside, and just by the tone of voice, I knew I was in trouble, and that was never a good thing for me in terms of how things would end up. So I remember standing there in the doorway of their bedroom, and they were, you know, just berating me for the things I had, the things I'd written, the book. I had taken a book off my mother's shelf. It was Judy Blume's Wifey, which was more of an adult themed book.
I remember. I remember the book.
And so there was suddenly, you know, I mean, I'd had many beatings, and I could sense that another one was on the way. And I remember standing there and looking at them, and it was almost as if they telescoped away from me. It was a very strange thing. And all I could hear was just my heart pounding. It's like their voices kind of receded, and, you know, along with the rest of them visually. And I could feel the front door behind me, and I turned and I ran, and I flung that front door open, and I kept running, and I ran out of the neighborhood, and I ran down the main road, and I kept going. And eventually made it to the grocery store a few miles away, which is not You know, because I was in the suburbs, and so where do you actually go?
It's either the gas station or the grocery store. I think you didn't need gas. I think you needed food.
Exactly. So that's where I went, and I kind of loitered around there for about 3 hours and called my mother from a payphone and begged her to take me back because, you know, you start to go back and forth, like, which is the better situation. And she said she couldn't. And then the police came and they brought me back. So that was the first time. So it was pretty short lived the first time.
What was the time that you actually broke away and ended up on the streets?
It started incrementally. So I kept running away after that. Well, we moved back to Maryland and that's where I really started to run away more frequently. And, I would run away and be gone for a few days and get caught or come back. And then I would, you know, so it kind of built like that, where I kept running away and then I'd get put in a group home and then I'd come home and then I'd run away again. And then everything changed, when I was 13.
You know, that was a big change. This is probably difficult, to talk about, but tell me about the first time you lost your virginity. I know it was particularly tragic. What happened?
I've read about this happening to other young women when they're with their mothers, and I don't know what this is, but maybe you do. But, you know, my mother started calling me a slut and a whore when I was 12, when I started to, you know, go through adolescence and, you know, started to look more toward a young woman and, started to play with makeup and, I had never even kissed a boy, but she was convinced that I was a hooker and a whore and a slut. And it was very confusing to me because I didn't know what I was doing wrong. And of course there were men everywhere, you know, eyeing up a young girl. And I started to kind of seek that attention because it was attention. And because I think that there's a way in which when you're abused as a child, you feel kind of wretched, like just absolutely ugly and unlovable. And so any attention at a certain point becomes...
That's absolutely true. The fact of the matter is it's why people could easily take advantage of a child who's been abused because they are so starved for anything positive. They're so starved for, you know, that it's not a function of the child's promiscuity. It's a function of the child's loneliness.
Exactly. Exactly. And some kind of validation that, that you're
lovable.
Want. Yeah, exactly. That you're lovable. And, so, you know, one of the times I had run away, I met an older man in an apartment building where my friend, my best friend at the time lived. And, he invited me up to his apartment and I went and, he pulled out, some pot and wine and I had, never had those things. And he immediately started trying to, kiss me and touch me and it scared me. And so I left and he gave me his phone number and I thought he was gross. I mean, he was, 33 or 34. Can't remember now. I think he was 34. Anyway, he gave me his phone number and I kept it in that red purse. And, one night, I guess a month later when I ran away again, I called that number. And, this time I went in knowing what I was doing and there was a kind of rebellion in a way. I don't know how much you want to know about that.
I guess I want to, rebellion in a sense, it sounds more to me like survival. You know, it sounds as when most people make choices, what happens when you're young, the only part of the brain that's formed is the reptilian, which is the addiction part of the brain, and the mammal brain, which is the emotional. The rational cognitive, the thinking brain, isn't really formed to around 18 to 25. So you just made the best emotional choice you could make at the time.
Well, that's really interesting. I've never heard it framed that way, but that makes a lot of sense. It was absolutely, I mean, I did it because I wanted a place to stay.
Was the experience terrible? What was the experience like? I mean, you were technically raped because you weren't under the age of consent, but what was the experience like for you?
Well, that's where the word rebellion came in, is that's how I got through it. I mean, I did it because, yeah, like I wanted to just have a place to stay, and I wanted to really, you know, I wanted to stop coming back to my parents. And so I resigned myself to the fact that this is probably what I was going to have to start doing. But how I got through it, it was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. I was a young girl, and I was in no way ready, even physically, to really be having sex. So it was incredibly painful. And how I got through it was basically, you know, well, I can't say what I was thinking on the air.
Oh, no, but, no, you could say anything here. Oh,
yeah,
my goodness.
No.
I encourage cursing.
Okay, then. So the whole time it was happening, or for maybe not the whole time, but for a lot of the time, it was like a mantra in my mind. I just kept thinking, fuck you, mom, fuck you, dad, fuck you, mom, fuck you, dad. And so that was the rebellious part. It's like, you know, basically, here it is. Here's your slut daughter. Here I am.
Actually, that was the coping part.
Was
okay?
That, yeah.
Yeah, meaning rebellion, you weren't even rebellious. Rebellion means that you're challenging a legitimate authority. You know, running away from mean, sadistic, crazy people is called seeking freedom. It's not called rebellion.
Well, you know, it's so refreshing to hear you say that, because, you know, that unfortunately the way the system was set up then, and I think to a large extent is still now, is that it's the child's fault. It's the child has behavioral problems, or the child is rebellious, or the child runs away, or and particularly in the 80s, you know, they weren't really focusing on the parents. You know, it wasn't that time when people said, well, what's going on at home? Maybe there's a reason.
Do you know why? It's because the parents are the ones who are paying the bills of the therapist. So the therapist knows if he blames the parents, he's done. So he blames the child.
That's really interesting.
It's an economic, and that's why most therapists, you know, I mean, not all, but most therapists, you know, do more damage than good.
Yeah, that's true. Well, and I wasn't even fortunate enough to have a therapist. These were just the people making decisions in group homes and things like that. So I guess there were therapists there, but already you can see the pattern that was emerging, which was I was getting put into placements, you know, for troubled kids. And what they were, you know, trying to make me do is promise that I would stop running away and stop being promiscuous.
As opposed to putting your parents into homes for troubled parents,
right,
you know, who need some shock therapy.
Oh, gosh. It might have helped. It might have, I mean, I hate, you know, like I said, I don't, you know, wish harm to them, but my gosh, they were so out of control, and, you know, maybe a little electroconvulsive therapy wouldn't have hurt.
It wouldn't have hurt, you know, and you could have controlled the switch, which would have made you feel better. Let me ask you a question. How did, and it almost had to happen because of the amount of pain and the amount of cognitive dissonance, how did drugs and alcohol start edging their way into your life?
Well, they were around. And as a runaway, I did kind of hope that I would find like a sweet little grandma who would, you know, take me in and bake me muffins and, you know, or even like carnival people, but that never happened. And, you know, instead it was often I was, you know, with older men and, you know, and with those people were a lot of drugs floating around. And so, they were there. And so I did them. And there was a kind of, you know, I mean, obvious escapism in that, But it wasn't until many years later that they actually really took a firm hold on me and almost killed me. So I used drugs as a runaway when they were around. But my primary concern at that time was still more than anything trying to find love.
Which is meaning the common thread among human beings is we have cosmic loneliness. We're tribal. We need to connect and we need to feel safe. So I guess I just want to emphasize that your need to feel and find love is not a function of anything wrong with you. It's a function of being human. And part of being human is being humane, which your parents didn't seem to do. Now, your mom had you arrested. How did that happen?
That's really where everything changed for me, unfortunately. She had been trying to, you know, I mentioned that I'd been in many group homes and, well, not many, but a few at that point. I guess I'd been in a couple of group homes and a psychiatric ward at that point. And she had been trying to have me locked up. There was a detention center in Maryland called Montrose, which was infamous. And that was where she wanted to have me sent. And so every time the police would bring me back, she would say, why can't you take her there? And they said, well, you know, running away isn't a crime. She would need to, you know, commit a crime in order for us to, you know, put her in a detention center. So one night I was staying there. Actually, it was the night that I kind of decided that I wanted to stop running away. I had gotten kind of beaten down being on the streets, and school was about to start. And I called my father and said, I just want to come back and go to school. You know, I was tired of having sex with older men. I was tired of not knowing, like, when I would eat or where I would sleep. And I, you know, and I missed school. I had been in the gifted and talented, you know, and I kind of wanted to just try to have a normal life again. Well, not again. I was still trying to have a normal life, period. I was trying to live at home again. So I had been on the run, and I stayed with my mother that night. I called my father. She heard the phone call, and I think it made her mad that I was going to go back and be with him. And so she started accusing me of all these things that were actually untrue. She was accusing me of being high that night, and I wasn't. And so I just said, look, I'm going to go to the neighbors and stay there, because she was yelling. It was escalating very quickly, and I wanted to just leave. And so I tried to go for the phone, and back then the phone was corded, you know, to the wall. And I went to go for the phone, and she took it and sat in a chair and held it away from me. And I went to reach for it, and she kicked me, so I kind of blocked her leg, and she fell back in the chair. It was an accident, and I immediately, you know, tried to help her up and said I was so sorry. And she called 911, and she pressed assault and battery charges on me. And that changed my whole life, because then I became a juvenile delinquent. I became a ward of the court, and I did go to Montrose.
You actually did. What was that experience like? And why didn't they believe the story you told?
Again, I think that, you know, well, one thing is when we finally went to court, so they took me to Montrose, and I stayed there until my arraignment, and went to court, and my mother brought my diary in, and she read to the court, you know, that I wrote about having sex, and basically presented me as a, you know, promiscuous, you know, drug abusing, you know, rebellious, behavioral problem having child. And I told the story, and I told the truth, just as I told it to you just now. And the judge just didn't believe me. So, and you know, my mother has admitted, you know, that she knew, like she did that specifically to have me locked up. But her reason is that she, you know, what she's said since then is she, you know, didn't know what was going to happen to me on the streets, and she thought that was a safer place. So that's, you know, that's her reasoning.
It's interesting. It's so interesting that when people have problems, they do one of two things, one of three things. They either get help and recognize that they need to change and they need to be healed. They get very, very depressed and don't function, or they become cruel and sadistic. It's really a shame that you had to be on the end of someone who chose that path.
It was because I could see her pain, and because I am, you know, on the scale of empathy, I'm really on one far end where I have, you know, like, you know, I used to cry when an ambulance would go by because I would feel bad for the person inside. So, you know, I actually had a lot of empathy for my mother, and I could see her pain. And for many, many years, I kept trying to love her, even though so much hatred came back at me. And I mean, this is the woman who came after me with a knife and ripped clothes off my back. I mean, but I thought if I could love her into wholeness, I could fix her, then she could be a mother. And so it wasn't completely altruistic. I wanted to make her better so that I could have a mother.
No. You know what? It's funny. There's a verse in Proverbs that says, speak into the ear of a wise man and he'll love you. But if you speak into the ear of a fool, they'll despise you even more. And you're wanting to have a parent, you know, to love you. It's not selfish any more than a baby wanting a bottle to be, you know, to fill up their stomach. You know, selfish is the inability to share. There's, I don't detect a single selfish bone in your body. You know, wanting what you need is what we do for survival.
You're very wise. I keep talking to you all day.
Thank you. You wrote so wisely in your own book that people don't care about other people. I think that right now is really the state where the world is. I don't think it's everyone. I think some people do. Unfortunately, the people that do are generally less powerful than the ones that don't. Was that the hardest lesson for you to learn?
It really was and is to this day. I look around and I see that, you know, empathy just sort of waning at, you know, from humanity, and it breaks my heart. But as a child, yeah, that on the streets, you know, I kept looking for kindness, love, and it was a very hard lesson to learn, which, you know, over and over again, that.
And here's why, Rita. Meaning, in order to love someone, you first have to have self-love. You know, if you don't have self-love, then what you're simply doing is going to be able to manipulate another person to give you what they want. And there's not a lot of people that really have a genuine respect and love for themselves.
Absolutely. And that fundamentally was my mother. I think she had so much self-loathing. She was just uncomfortable in her own skin. And so I lived that truth. Yeah.
Sensitive subject. You know, when you were young, you had a lesbian relationship with a girl that was your first consensual lesbian relationship. This person seemed to, in fact, you know, make you feel, you know, a lot less abused and more safe. Was that part of your search for love?
Yeah, that was actually, we were in one of the facilities. I was in a total of 8 juvenile treatment facilities or detention centers, hospitals, and some of them multiple times. And this was the last place I was in. And, we shared a room in this place, and it was actually the nicest place we had been in. Like, you know, it was open door facility, you know, there were mountains around us. It was a place that fostered love to begin with. So that was kind of the context that we were living there in. And, when I had sex with, you know, men and women at that point, you know, on the run, but that was all for survival. And I never, enjoyed it. And then I became friends with this girl, and she came to my bed one night, and it was absolutely healing, because, you know, to be a sexual being, to have desire, but to not have that realized in actual sex with other people is a strange feeling, because you're carrying that alone. And your body is just being kind of worn down by being used by people over and over. And so to kiss somebody I actually wanted to kiss and to feel that desire and somebody that I actually cared about and cared about me was huge. So,
yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting that the sexual desire, and the desire for intimacy wasn't crushed, meaning, which is just a testament, you know, to you. Now, here's the amazing part. You ended up getting married to a top neurosurgeon who's actually a great husband. How in the world did that happen? Not that you absolutely don't deserve it more than anyone else, but tell me how that happened.
Well, you know, I got myself eventually together. I when I was 19, I almost died from a drug addiction, and realized that I in fact, didn't want to die. I wanted to live every day. I mean, I wanted to really live my life. And so I went on the journey of healing. And a few years later, I went to college. And, and I had actually never, you know, gone to high school. So I had to go get a GED, having never set foot inside a high school. because I, you know, was running away, and I basically, you know, eighth grade was as far as I went. And I got my GED, and I went to college, and I fell in love with literature, and I continued. I'd always been a writer, and I continued writing, and then I, you know, went to grad school, and I got a job as a technical writer, and so I was living a good life for myself, and I met my husband at a party, and he was incredibly sweet, and we just hit it off, and it happened pretty quickly after that. But, you know, but interestingly enough, my past really troubled him. And I think that it was hard for him for a long time.
It's funny that you bring that up because, you know, I've been doing coaching in neuroplasticity, which is medical hypnosis, for 37 years. And I do encourage my clients not to tell about their past, simply because some people don't have the ability to separate the evolutionary process of the human spirit, that you know, a butterfly is not a caterpillar. It came from there, but it looks nothing, acts nothing, and feels nothing like that. Did he get over that problem?
Well, it's interesting, and I love that.
If he didn't, have him call me.
Pardon? I should have him call.
I will get him over that problem. Tell him I think he's the luckiest guy alive, so if you got a problem, you have him call me.
You are the sweetest, absolutely the sweetest. You know, I don't know if he's ever fully gotten over that, to be honest. He's a lot better about it. But, you know, it was a real struggle in our marriage because I wanted him, you know, there's a quote attributed to the Buddha, which is that I mentioned in my book, which is how sweetly the lotus grows in the litter of the wayside, and, you know, meaning that the lotus comes up through even like the murkiest, muddiest water, and it doesn't retain a trace of that dirt. And that's how I have felt in my life. Like, I've been through everything that I've been through, and yet I still feel a sense of innocence and wonder and joy at just even the smallest things about being alive, and that should count for something. And I have a heart full of love, and so, but my past is also part of me, and I think that it was difficult.
But you know what? Meaning, I love that quote which you just told, and it is truly a reflection of you. But here's the truth. The truth is, if we look at any country, even our own, and we look back on how we even we completed the manifest destiny, which was, you know, hurting and killing a lot of innocent people, many Native Americans and so on and so forth, and all the injustice that takes place in the world. Some people simply don't, you know, they don't see the forest from the trees. And that's why information is a weapon. I tell people, you don't give it, you know, out freely. You know, and I really seriously mean this. Your husband is obviously a very good man, but he should really appreciate the fact that you could have in fact taken the worst from your parents, and you did just the opposite. You in fact just allowed yourself to be filled with love regardless of everything you went through. And nothing should be held against you. If anything, I'd be pretty proud of that.
Hmm. You know. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. I want you to tell me. This is kind of interesting. When did you start having the panic attacks? I think it was after your marriage.
It was.
That fascinates me. Why the panic attack after your marriage? Because usually that happens is when you get afraid you're going to lose something. Was it the fact that you felt a little bit? Well, you tell me.
Well, you know, it was an interesting time because we had just moved to Massachusetts from Maryland, and to, you know, my like dream house, and in this beautiful bucolic area, you know, kind of farmland out here, but I was really isolated, and I think, but there's a way. I've thought about this before because I've asked that same question, and I think it's kind of like, you know, when you work really, really hard and then you go on vacation and you get sick.
Right.
And it felt kind of like that. Like, I'd finally arrived at this peaceful place, and it was almost like it was finally safe for me to to break down a little bit, because you don't have that luxury. Like, as a runaway, or, you know, as I've been like sort of fighting to survive for a lot of my life, and you don't have that, like I said, that luxury to just stop and, you know, I think the adrenaline is used more for moving forward, but, you know, here I was in this quiet place, and, you know, it's just out of the blue, it started. And I think, you know, they say that it's panic attacks can be triggered by a move or that kind of thing. And so, you know, there were some, you know, external factors happening in our lives. I mean, we moved here. Larry started a really difficult job. He was having a lot of problems. I felt very, very isolated. And
I mean, panic attacks normally have two aspects to it. One is they always come from a sense of cosmic loneliness and detachment, you know, and the other is a fear of loss. I mean, actually, there's a few more, but for the most part, it's the emotional brain not being able to submit to the rational part of the brain, because panic is almost a form of superstition, especially when there's no one chasing you. You know, now it could also have been for you that you've been through so much, and you're right, you just allowed yourself to break down a little bit.
Yeah, well, there was definitely a PTSD component, I think, to it, which is why,
absolutely.
You know, yeah, so cognitive behavioral therapy, which helps, what, like 90, 95% of the people who have panic attacks, it actually made me worse. And
it doesn't. Cognitive behavioral therapy actually doesn't, is very ineffective, because what happens is, that's why neuroplasticity or hypnotherapy works, is because it gives the rational brain the ability to dominate the emotions, and all of a sudden the panic attacks, your brain is rewired so you're not to panic. Because when you're talking cognitively, you're not talking to the part of the brain that goes through the panic.
That's really interesting.
The panic is the emotional part of the brain. So that's why rational cognitive therapy, even behavioral therapy, just doesn't really work.
Right, exactly, because it's completely removed from the emotional
aspect.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, you know, you can make statistics say anything, I suppose. That's what they say, right?
Well, so. You know, right. Who's going to challenge the statistics? So you can make them up as you go along.
Right, so I went in there thinking, oh, wow, you know, but of course I had the fear that I would be that small percentage of the people that they say it didn't help, and I was right, but, you know,
do you
now
still have panic?
Pardon?
Do you still have panic attacks?
I don't, except, you know, I still struggle driving on the highway. That's the one residual thing, so maybe I should come see you.
You know what? You absolutely should. You absolutely should. We'll get rid of that and anything else. It's interesting that horses played a big part in your book.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
And animals are just so soothing and so healing, because, you know, very often their only agenda is to give back the love which you give them.
Absolutely. They're so pure. I mean, I just, yeah, I think we could all stand as humans to be more like animals a lot of the time.
The good animals.
The good animals. The sweet puppies.
Exactly. You know, I have a boxer, Socrates, and he's just such a love bug.
You have a boxer named Socrates?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
He's just amazing. I want to so thank you for doing the show with me. You are terrific. Okay.
Oh, well,
and,
likewise.
I look forward to hearing from you, and I look forward to your continual evolution as that lily that has come out of the pond, very beautiful and very pure and not tainted. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's truly been a pleasure.
Bye, Rita.
Bye.
I am Dr. Errol Gluck, and I want you to remember, to every problem there is a solution. I am your problem solver. Check out our other episodes. There's something for everyone on GluckRadio.com. Keep listening and keep sending in your feedback. Till next time.